Today is April 29th, 2014, and this is episode number 252 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, critic at large. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at acm@macobserver.com. Welcome back.
Why, thank you.
We missed you. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Well, that's nice.
We need to have a talk about what?
About the interns and the locks on the closet doors. And letting me out when I say.
Yes, fair enough. Fortunately, while you were indisposed, Dave filled in last week.
Dave's a trooper.
He is a trooper, and apparently a resident cough drop addict.
Well, you know, we all have our little vices, and at least his isn't a controlled substance, so...
Fair enough.
There's that.
Fair enough. Speaking of controlled surfaces, why don't you put that as a bullet point on our discussion about the interns for later?
Yes, I think that's a really good... Yeah. Hold on, I'll make a note right now. Oh, okay.
Excellent. So let's see here. It's been 2 weeks since you and I spoke. It's been a week since we actually put out a podcast, at least you by proxy.
Right.
and it's been an interesting week. Of course, last week we recorded right before the earnings report. So that was last week, and Apple, of course, had a blowout quarter.
Yes, they did.
Yeah, and announced the stock split.
Yep, that 7-1.
7-1. Yeah, keeps people from fixating on the multiplier. By the way, it's like, well, it used to be worth $500. No one's going to do the math by seven.
No. Most people dividing by two is pretty difficult.
Yep.
But with dividing by seven, you might as well be dealing with particle physics.
Right. Because Apple could have done a 10-1 split. But, you know, the stock would have been a $30 or $40 stock. And 10-1, actually, what am I saying? Would have been a $55 stock at the time that they announced it.
See? Quantum physics.
Math are hard, but they didn't do that. They picked 7-1, which means we all have more shares. Well, at least I now have 7 times as many of the paltry amount of shares that I used to have, or I will in June. I'm doing a terrible job on this.
Yeah, June 9th. That's when trading starts on the split adjusted stock.
Right. And it's shareholders of record as of June 2nd.
Correct.
Who get the 7-1. I have a confession. I'm not actually sure what happens in between the 2nd and the 9th. I don't know if Apple doesn't trade. My assumption is that Apple won't trade during that week.
That would be my guess, too.
Because that's the only way to do it. I mean, you can't, you know, if it's shareholders of record on the 2nd who get the split, and the trading on the split shares doesn't begin until the 9th, obviously no one's going to want to buy 1/7 of a share for 7 times the price in the intervening time. So I think it's going to end up going off the market while all the accounting is done. That's my guess.
That would make sense, because
I could have found out, I suppose.
Yeah, but what's the fun in that?
That's right, listeners. What's the fun in that?
Yeah, it's not about knowing. It's about having fun guessing.
It's the truthiness. It feels very truthy to me that the shares will go off the market for that week while all the accounting gets done. But, you know, that's never happened. But you know what? I should find that out.
Yeah. Yeah, because you are, after all, a shareholder of insignificant value, and so this matters to you.
I've been covering Apple's stock for 15 years. I should know this.
And really, it's not like they've ever done a split before. Oh, wait.
Yeah, exactly. There have been two splits since 2000. Yeah, this one was so long overdue. It drives me nuts that they weren't doing splits.
Well, it could be that they were pissed off at analysts and other investors like Warren Buffett, people like that, saying Apple needs to do a stock split, and they were like, you know what, screw you.
Yeah, Warren Buffett didn't say that. As a matter of fact, Warren Buffett's company has never done a split and trades at $190,000 a share.
That's not the point. I'm doing bad impressions.
Yeah, fair enough. But he's never. I had wondered if it was Warren Buffett's influence over that, but I don't even understand this about Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett is a man who has gone on record as he's told Congress to stop coddling the super rich, referring to taxation. In other words, stop cutting taxes on the super rich because they're the ones who can afford to pay. You know, Warren Buffett himself is a super rich person, one of the wealthiest people on the planet.
So he's in a position to know whether or not super rich people can pay.
Yes, he is. Absolutely. He's gone on record supporting progressive taxation policies. Yet the effect of his company never doing a stock split has put it into the realm of only institutional buyers and the super rich being able to ever trade the company. You can do it. You can buy into a trust fund. I'm sorry, trust fund. A mutual fund is very, very similar.
But if you have a trust fund.
If you have a trust fund, that probably helps. You can buy into a mutual fund that trades the stock. But, at $190,000, the day I wrote up the explanation of what Apple stock split meant.
And thank you for doing that. That was so helpful.
Of course. 128 shares had traded hands of Berkshire Hathaway. That's Warren Buffett's company. 128 shares. And that basically means that only the super wealthy and institutional investors are involved in the stock, and it takes it well out of the realm of normal folks being able to participate in all the wealth creation that Warren Buffett has done through Berkshire Hathaway. So this is at odds to me, and I don't understand it.
Yeah, it's maybe it's a do as I say, not as I do kind of thing.
Well, I'm sure the reality is that Warren Buffett's a tad bit smarter than me, and that there's probably a reason for what he's doing. I'm comfortable with that notion. But in the meanwhile, back to Apple. One of the reasons why I wrote that piece that what the 7-to-1 stock split actually means is that a lot of people think that somehow because they're going to have more shares, they're going to have more money. But it's really important to understand that the value of your holdings doesn't change because of a stock split. It's the only way a stock split helps you, the shareholder, is if there is a subsequent increase in the stock price, but that would have affected you anyway. And that's one thing, analysts and institutional buyers and the hedge funds and the mutual funds, they all understand that it doesn't matter if Apple's stock is does a split or not, because to them, you're buying $1 million worth of a company. The number of shares is irrelevant as long as everyone is buying, in at the same level. If that makes any sense. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, that makes sense. It's everyone's on a level playing field.
Yeah, yeah. The shares that someone is buying are worth the same amount of the company that someone else's shares are. It doesn't matter, and they don't care. But for normal folks, for retail investors, who, by the way, make up a very tiny percent of the stock market, that's actually quite important. We retail investors kind of don't matter all that much. But we do matter a little bit, but the reality is that when a share is trading at $400 or $500 a share, or $1,000 a share, or $190,000 a share, as that increases, it makes it less and less possible for retail investors of limited means to buy into a company and participate in their wealth generation.
Right. So splitting the stock, in essence, opens up the stock to investors that wouldn't otherwise be able to get in, meaning those of us without trust funds.
Correct. And or, you know, those of us who don't have big salaries. You know, I mean, there are many ways to be wealthy other than having a trust fund. But, you know, when a stock is trading at $70 a share, let's actually reverse this. Let's say, look at Apple. So Apple is at $5.50 before the stock split. And let's say someone has $200 to invest. That's not a lot of money. It's just really not a lot of money. But let's say even that you have $200 a month that you want to invest. Well, you go try to buy shares of Apple at $550. You can't even get one share.
Right.
Okay. Let's say that you have $1,000 to invest. Well, you look at Apple, or let's just for the sake of math, let's do $1,100. You have $1,100 to invest. And you're looking at buying Apple, and you can buy two shares of Apple. Well, golly, two shares. Boy, that means I'm paying $5.50 a piece for the transaction. Right? For the brokerage fee. And, you know, that's a little off-putting for people who are actually keeping track of that. Just the notion of, like, God, I'm only going to have two shares of Apple. Well, I could buy 10 shares or 100 shares or 150 shares of this other company. Boy, that kind of makes me feel a little bit better as an investor. Now, the reality is that the math doesn't care about our feelings. You're going to invest $1,100 into a company. It doesn't really matter how many shares you get. But that psychological factor does play into things. And retail investors do get intimidated when it comes to buying a company with a really high share price. So you have both the people who don't necessarily have an amount to buy even one share of a company, but then you also have the people who are put off in buying one or two shares of a company, and now those people will be able to participate more in buying shares of Apple.
Yeah, so that's cool. I like the idea of more people being able to invest. For people that are in the game long term, those are the people that can get really excited. Like when people bought a bunch of shares of Apple at $15 back in the day, and then that stock split.
And then split again.
And then split again, and they held on to their stock all that time. That those $15 shares, they ended up with, what, four times the stock they originally had. And it's gone up close to $600. So in that sense, they suddenly have a lot more for their investment. But that's long term,
right? And a lot of retail investors are long term. As a matter of fact, Apple does have a lot of normal folks investing in the company, because, you know, like the fans of the company tend to also let me rephrase this. Apple has probably a higher percentage of fans who are shareholders than many other companies. That's what I'm trying to say. And so, you know, we do like to participate in being an Apple shareholder, and the stock split will help with that. I frankly wish they'd done a 17-to-1 split. I wish, you know, they put the stock down around $20 or $30 a piece, because I think that when Apple releases a new product category later this year, I think that stock's going to go on another big run, and you know, the bigger the split that Apple had done, the longer the share will be in within reach of retail investors.
Yeah, that's true.
And one last thing, don't get me wrong, there are plenty of retail investors who are going to buy $10,000 of shares, $10,000 worth of a stock at a time, or $100,000. You know, retail investors are not just us poors, right? Retail investors, you know, there are definitely wealthy people who count as retail investors because they're doing their own investing. And I certainly I've known people who have gotten wealthy. I've talked to people, I should say, who have gotten wealthy just from Apple stock. Because they did invest back when the shares were at $15 pre-split. you know?
Yeah, and that's really cool.
Yeah, it is. So yeah, I'm not trying to paint in too broad strokes, but I'm glad to see this stock split.
Yeah, I'm curious to see when the stock starts trading at the split adjusted level, if there's like a mad dash for people to buy up more stock.
Well, probably not. Probably at least not enough to have much of an effect. Again, retail investors are a small part of the market. There's more likely to be a run-up before the split because people, you know, again, there's that psychological effect. Well, if I buy pre-split, then I'll have 7 shares. You know, it doesn't matter that you could buy 7 shares after the split. I suspect we'll get a little bit of a run-up before the split. And depending on what happens at WWDC, right? If Apple somehow blows the doors off stuff, you know, we could have another run afterwards, but...
That's true. Oh, and WWDC is happening after the split adjusted
right.
Trading begins.
Right. So if there is a big increase, or if there is even a steady increase in Apple's share post split, it's more than likely going to be news and rumor driven than it is split driven.
Okay, I can see that.
So that is that. Now we weren't going to talk about this wasn't even on the agenda.
But this is how we roll, Brian. Just so, working outside the box here.
Let's nerd it up a little bit.
Okay, let's get all nerdy.
Let's nerd it up a little bit.
Do you want me to talk nerdy to you?
Yes, I do. I want you to talk nerdy to me about comic books.
Oh, this is about to become a 2-hour show.
Yay!
All right. So the backstory is, because we know everyone loves some backstory, or I guess we could call it the origin story.
I see what you did there. Yeah. I like it too.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Okay. So the origin story for this is that a couple weeks ago, Amazon bought Comixology, and Comixology is the largest online digital comic reseller. And they have the largest number of titles from the widest range of comic publishers out of any of the online companies that are doing this. And so Amazon bought them.
Yay! Right?
Well, that's what we were hoping for.
I wasn't. I never had any delusions.
Yeah, well, yeah, neither did I. I was actually worried from the beginning, and I shared my concerns in the piece that I wrote about Amazon buying Comixology. And then it turns out over the weekend, those fears started to be realized because Comixology released a new version of their app that takes out in-app purchase options. So now, just like with the Kindle app on the iPad, you have to go to a web page, make your purchases there, and then go back to the application.
Okay, but hold on right there. Just the way you frame that, I'm going to take issue.
That's okay.
Amazon did that because of Apple.
Yes, they did that because of Apple.
This Comixology bit is about, well, it's probably about margins too, but it's about control and ecosystem. But the in-app purchase of goods and books from both the Amazon app from the App Store and the Kindle app from the App Store was all about Apple demanding 30% of each and every purchase and that all purchases must go through Apple.
Mm-hmm.
And those margins, that was the 30% margins that the Amazon simply didn't have and couldn't pay and that most retailers cannot pay, meaning that the App Store today is the only in-app purchases are like in-app upgrades and or digital goods.
and up until just a couple days ago, comic books. And well, actually, you can still buy comics through other apps. It's just a Comixology app. You can't do that anymore. The 30% piece doesn't seem to have been, as far as I can tell, an issue for Comixology up until Amazon bought them.
Right. Yeah, I believe that Amazon's move with Comixology is about ecosystem and control.
Yeah, I don't think this is about the margins per se. I don't think this is about Apple's 30%. Well, this is about Amazon having total control of the comic book.
Yeah, and comic book Amazon wants that 30% back because Amazon thinks... Yeah, Comixology didn't have a built-in... didn't have a built-up platform until they built it up through the App Store.
Yes.
Amazon does. Amazon has a gajillion customers. And Amazon... Amazon is banking literally on being able to leverage its existing customer base to continue to sell. Because, you know, if Amazon can sell 71% as many comic books as Comixology did as an independent, they win.
Sure.
Right.
And they may be able to do that. But what do they really win? That's what I'm wondering. Because if they're selling 71% of what Comixology sold in a market, meaning the comic book market, where publishers have been struggling for several years to drive sales up, and Amazon now drives them down, how does that help that market?
Oh, it doesn't. You know, Amazon sucks all of the... that was an unintentional pause.
And because, stick with that.
Because, yeah. No. I have so many mixed feelings about Amazon. So many mixed feelings about Amazon. But Amazon sucks the profits out of every market that they enter. They suck the profits out, which... My problem, you know, as a consumer, hooray, I get cheap stuff. But my concern as a consumer of quality products is that when you suck all the profits out, there is no room for quality anymore.
Right.
To wit, look at Walmart. Look at, you know, when you buy, it turns out, folks, when you buy 10 tube socks for a dollar, they suck.
Turns out, I can verify that for you personally.
Yeah, well, everyone can. And there's a fine line between making commerce more efficient and sucking all the profits out so that there's no longer any room for anyone else to do any R&D. Any investment, companies no longer can afford to pay, middle class incomes, you know, all for salaries. There is a fine line between making stuff more efficient and destroying innovation by reducing all the profits. And as the proof in that pudding, let's look at the PC market and let's look at Apple going back to the 90s.
That's an excellent example.
Apple, the PC industry was headed towards ever smaller margins led by the grand toaster maker Dell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Dell was putting all of its research into, as the way I euphemistically put it, was how to put one less screw in a computer.
And for a while, it worked really well for them.
Yeah, it did. It worked really, really well for them. And they were better at that than everybody. You know, Dell was better on the manufacturing side than everybody. And, of course, what happened is two things happened. One, everybody started moving their manufacturing offshore to China and Taiwan, mainly. because they couldn't compete with Dell's manufacturing. And then eventually Dell itself had to move its manufacturing. But that means that Dell lost that edge that it had used to dominate the PC industry. And the other thing that happened was that Steve Jobs came back to Apple and changed the rules by which Apple competed. He turned the computer experience, he turned the Mac experience into competing on experience and quality and style and ease of use and all these other things other than price and specs.
Yes, and then here's all these companies trying to compete with Apple, and they don't realize they're not on the same playing field.
Yeah, they can't compete with Apple because they can't do their own R&D because there were no more margins in the PC industry. But Apple had margins. Apple took its margins back up to 20 and then 30%, and then they eventually crossed over 30%. But those initial margin increases paid for the development of a little thing called the iPod. It paid for the R&D on a little thing called the iTunes Store, or iTunes, and then the iTunes Store. And then it paid for the margins from both of those products. Well, not iTunes, actually was a money loser for a long time. But so the margins on the iPod and the Mac paid for the development of the iPhone, and they all paid for the development of the iPad, and then the Mac App Store. You know, all these other things, all the things that we know of today as the Apple ecosystem are made possible by the fact that Apple has margins that make a profit. An enormous profit. And Apple uses some of those profits for more R&D. And that's something that other companies can't do. And that's always my worry about Amazon, is that they're sucking the profits out of everything so that no one can do R&D. I worry about it on the publishing side. Of course, I am an aspiring author myself. And now I worry about it from the comic book side too, which is where Comixology comes into it.
Yes, and yeah. So Comixology was in a really unique place in the overall comic publishing industry, because they were able to push the market to a place where people could buy digital instead of going into a comic book store.
Yeah, actually, why don't you describe what the Comixology app is for readers or listeners that don't know?
Okay, so the app it's a marketplace for comic books. And it's like going into the biggest comic book store you could possibly imagine, being able to find everything there, buy it, and walk out and read it. And even flip through a few pages of each issue before you buy it to make sure it's what you really wanted. And so what it did was it opened up the comic book buying experience to the masses, where previously you were either limited to just what was available at your convenience store or grocery store on a little spinner rack, or you had to seek out the few comic book shops that are scattered around cities.
But to be fair, you could also order physical comic books from Amazon.
You could, but doing the browsing of titles, that was a lot harder on Amazon.
Yeah, that's an issue for books too. You know, it yes. is a better shopping experience to walk into a Barnes & Noble or, you know, one of the better independents than it is to shop for a book online. The discovery, the same thing with records. And, well, I'm old. The same thing with CDs any kind of music. Now, the discovery process is better in the real world than it is in the virtual world, and no one has cracked that code yet. Not even Amazon, who has come closer than everybody because they've done such a great job of, you know, if people who browse this end up buying this stuff, you know, that all that sort of stuff. Amazon is better than everybody, and it's still not as good of a shopping experience for books or anything else or comic books. The end.
Yes, but now Comixology has come closer than anyone else to giving us that in-store experience in an app, which has been great, because while they have been able to help push the market away from traditional print comics, which steals business from the stores, that also ultimately will lead back to sales in the stores, because when you can start bringing in more of the casual reader market, you will get a subset of those people that will have a deeper interest and will want to explore more titles, and then at some point will want to explore print versions of titles. Trust me on this one. It's okay. Just trust me on this one. So the print industry. Okay, I've talked to a lot of comic book shops, and they see the digital era of comics as something that they can ultimately profit from if they play their cards right. Which means that there will be comic book shops that survive and others that will fail because they don't know how to play the game in that market. When you take the ease of purchase away from the digital side, you take away that ability to a degree for the traditional brick and mortar comic book stores to play off of that and grow their user base.
Okay.
And so what Amazon is doing is they're taking over the digital comic market at the expense of the digital comic market, which ultimately will lash back and be a bad thing for the print market as well.
Yeah, well, for sure. This is essentially the same fear that I have about publishing, although slightly different. So I'm quibble. My sounds of strained thought.
I just thought you had gas, but go ahead.
Related to saying that digital exposure will lead to more brick and mortar customers, to me, hasn't borne out for music or books, and I don't see how it's going to happen for comic books either. I think that for the brick and mortar comic store, that they're under the same long term threat that brick and mortar bookstores are and that CD stores are. And the only the very best are going to survive. And the effect of Amazon buying Comixology is either not going to change that formula or it's going to accelerate it. But it's not going to have a deleterious effect on what otherwise would have been a positive effect.
That's a lot of big words.
Yeah, can I play devil's advocate against myself?
Yeah, go ahead, because I was about to do that, but I'll let you take on that role for the moment, and then I'll jump in. Brian, let's gang up on you.
Yeah, let's do that. The flip side of this coin, the thing that sets comic books apart from books and music, traditional mainstream books and traditional mainstream music, is that comic books have a stigma. That they have been battling for decades, and it's not serious literature, it's not serious reading, it's for kids. Grown-ups don't read, comic books, and adults that do read comic books are somehow either socially retarded or even socially even mentally stagnated. This is a reality. That stigma exists. Now, that stigma mm-hmm. is being pushed back more and more, especially in the last 10 years. We've seen from the success of, especially in the, and as a matter of fact, I think that Hollywood's embracing of comic books has probably helped push that back a lot. Going back to the first Batman movies and the Spider-Man movies, I'm going to say that as much as Christopher Reeve was awesome, that his franchise did not help the cause.
No, I don't think it did either. I will agree with you on that.
And I love him. He's awesome. He was awesome.
He was awesome. What he did was bring validity to the superhero movie.
He did, but I don't think. Yeah, I don't think it helped the.
It didn't help the comic book industry as much as later movies did. But without Christopher Reeve's Superman movies,
I don't think
we would have had the follow-ups.
You're totally right. You don't get
Batman. Tim Burton's Batman,
right?
Which then opened up new doors, and ultimately we have all of the many Batman movies, Avengers movies, Iron Man, Thor.
That's true. Without Tim Burton's Batman, we don't get Christian Bale's awesome Dark Knight.
Right. Right. And without those strong movies like that coming along,
we don't get the Avengers.
Yeah, we don't get the Avengers, and we don't have an industry that's strong enough to do what it did, which was to survive the Fantastic Four movies.
But Jessica Alba.
Jessica Alba, that, yeah, there is that. We also survived the Daredevil movie.
I like the Daredevil movie. I did. It's true. I also liked Jennifer Garner's... oh my goodness, what was her character called? I'm not a comic book guy.
Let's see, we had the Red Sonja movie, which...
What was Jennifer Garner's thing? She did a standalone movie for the character that she played in Daredevil.
Oh, right. And now I'm just suddenly drawing a blank. But
that in particular was a really good movie, but it also didn't really feel much like a comic book movie. As a matter of fact, I don't even know. I have no idea how well those stuck with the comic books or anything else. I'm not qualified. Okay, fair enough.
But not sticking to the comic books isn't necessarily a bad thing, because there are some stories that just simply don't play well on screen in the way they do in print. So you take the concept and you make it into something that works on screen. I'm totally okay with that.
Elektra.
That's right. Elektra.
Yeah, turns out we have this thing called the internet.
That's crazy. I don't know.
I liked the Elektra film though. I thought it was.
I had no interest in seeing it at all. I did not get through the Daredevil movie.
Fair enough. Keep in mind that Ben Affleck is not in Elektra. You should. I challenge you to watch it and get back to us next week.
All right. If it's on Netflix streaming.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah, because if it's like the Green Lantern movie, I will be really pissed off that I spent a dollar to watch it.
I will reimburse your dollar if you don't like Elektra.
All right, fair enough. So here's my dirty little secret. The first Captain America movie I thought was bad.
I didn't see that one.
My advice is don't bother. Because I haven't seen
the Thor movies either.
Okay, there you go.
And I saw the Avengers because Joss Whedon wrote and directed it.
Yeah, the Avengers was good. I almost didn't see the Avengers because Captain America was going to be in it. He has to be. He's part of the Avengers. But I disliked the Captain America movie so much, I felt that it was going to ruin the Avengers for me.
Fair enough. The trailers for the new Captain America film look fantastic.
They do. And I went to see it, although I just haven't gone to the theater to see it yet.
Fair enough.
Which shows you how high on my list that is. But I'll go see it.
Okay, so let's get back to Amazon and Comixology.
Right. Okay. So
I was making the case that the difference between the comic book industry and music and books and vis-a-vis the brick and mortar situation is that the comic books have suffered a stigma that has been pushed back in probably the last 10 or 15 years in particular, and that therefore exposure to more people through a digital means may in fact be why they could benefit, the brick and mortar stores could benefit from that exposure.
Yes, there's that. Yeah, that's a big thing right there. Absolutely. You also have another aspect that comic book stores can take advantage of, can exploit in a good way, that that other stores haven't been able to capitalize on in the same way. And that's the other merchandising. There's a lot of people that are really into the action figures and the sculptures and posters and all of these other collectible things that go along with the industry. There's there's also a lot of crossover with the gaming industry, like role-playing games, board games.
Sure.
And so you get a lot of crossover with that in the comic stores. Put all those pieces together, and the best of the comic stores have figured out they can become what I think of as community centers. And they are doing other things that go along with the retail part, which is they'll have gaming nights. And that's true. Yeah, and then they have special events that tie in to whatever is happening in the movie comic side of things. So there's a lot that they can do, but part of what they need is this relationship with the digital comic side, because that is to a degree a gateway into the traditional comic store. It's not a huge gateway, and in many cases it has not been an effective gateway, but everything was moving down the path where it could be far more than it is. And I believe with Amazon taking the ease of use out of Comixology, that they have put a wall up at a time when any wall is bad, and I fear it's going to get worse, and that we ultimately will be limited to just Amazon's own Kindle interface for viewing comic books. And I have purchased comic books for Kindle specifically so that I could read them. I've bought comics I already own for comparison, and it is horrible. Absolutely horrible.
If it's any consolation, I think that Amazon would be more likely to go the route of using Comixology and rebranding it and incorporating it as Kindle Comics.
I could see that. If they can figure out a way to make it totally seamless with what they already have, sure. Because I think what they want is as comparable an experience across platforms as they can get. Which, on one hand, is kind of surprising, because why wouldn't they want to just make the best experience on their own hardware? But for them, their hardware is a way of locking people into their market, but they want to make sure everyone can get into their market.
Yes. And so another factor here is, I guess I'm asking, that this is more of a clarification for myself. I had thought that Google Play, i.e. Google, was charging this Comixology the same 30% that Apple was charging. Is that not the case?
I think it is the case. I'm not 100% certain on that, but I believe that is correct.
Well, in your coverage, though, you wrote that they were adding in-app purchases to the Google Play app.
And that Comixology said that was one of the single most, or one of the highest requested features.
Well, this is why I'm confused, because these two concepts are in contradiction.
I agree.
So one of them is that they were already doing it, and Google Play was taking the same 30%, and that Amazon was pulling that out. And the other one is that they're adding it in because it hasn't been there, and is a requested feature.
Yes. There you go. Yeah. So it wasn't in the Google app. You had to go to the Comixology website. That's been changed, so now you can do in-app purchases.
I see.
And on the iOS side, the feature has been removed, so now you have to go to the store or right. to the website.
Okay, well then let's get back to the Apple equation on this. Because this is happening. Whether or not the ultimate goal for Amazon is control and ecosystem, whether or not that's the ultimate goal, the reality is that Amazon is only doing this on iOS because of Apple's 30% cut. I have always, when Apple first announced this, my knee-jerk reaction was that Apple risks, that Apple has more to gain from making the iPad the best shopping experience on the planet, and that by enforcing this 30% rule, that Apple risk allowing other devices to claim that role instead.
They do risk that.
Now, Dave Hamilton had a fantastic counterargument, and a counterargument, I might add, that I've never heard Apple make. And that counterargument is that Apple isn't so concerned about the 30%, which I don't actually think is the case. I think that Steve Jobs bridled at the notion that other people were able to make money off of his beautiful creation without paying him. I don't know that for a fact, but I've always suspected that. But Dave's point was that what Apple was trying to do is to ensure that customers know that if they buy something from an app that they downloaded from the App Store, that it is effectively curated and vetted the same as everything else, so that people couldn't be tricked into making an in-app purchase on their credit card or something like that by some bottom feeder out there.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is a worthy goal, but I still think this issue about allowing competing platforms to become a better shopping experience is a real danger for Apple.
Yes, that is a danger for Apple. If it's easier for people to and for resellers to get their products to customers and for customers to get those products outside of Apple's ecosystem, eventually that's how it will go.
Yeah.
And that's bad.
It is bad. So Amazon is getting boos and hisses for doing this on iOS, but it is a direct reaction to Apple's own policy of demanding 30% of everything purchased through an app in the App Store.
I think that's a substantial part of it. I think another part of it is Amazon wanting to control the complete experience.
Absolutely. But Amazon wouldn't even have that option if Apple hadn't given it to them by claiming this 30%. Matter of fact, I wonder, I don't know this by any stretch of the imagination, but I wonder how interested Amazon would have been in creating the Kindle Fire if Apple hadn't have instituted this 30% tax.
I think they still would have done that because the Kindle is, as a platform, just all their devices, primarily a media consumption tool, which Amazon has plenty of media to consume. It's also the gateway to the rest of the merchandise that they sell.
But I suspect that having a premier Amazon shopping app on the iPad may well have been the sweet spot for Amazon.
It may well have been.
We'll
never know. I'm thinking that there is a likelihood that Amazon would have created their own platform anyhow at some point, simply because if they can have complete control, if they can lock people in to purchasing only from them, then why wouldn't they do that? If they have the premier platform through the iPad, that's great, but everyone else can have that too.
Right. One more point before we should move on to the next topic, but one more point on this. For comic book fans, here's the worry. Amazon can turn the Comixology purchase into something that is great for Amazon and is bad for comic books.
I think that's where we're headed.
That's the worry. And I think it's a very legitimate worry. I think that Amazon, like I said, Amazon can, if Amazon sells 71% of the same number of comics while keeping the 30%, Amazon wins, but publishers lose.
Yes,
publishers lose, the artists lose, the creators lose, and to a certain extent, the fans will end up losing because that will eventually lead to fewer comics. So, and that's the problem with Amazon's business model, is that their business model means that they can win while industries and ultimately consumers lose. And that's my concern about Amazon in a nutshell.
I'm with you there. I fear that what's happened with Comixology is good only for Amazon.
Yes. Yeah. And that they're going to end up having the same monopoly power in comic books that they have in ebooks and increasingly in physical books too.
Yeah,
that's worrisome.
It is. That this is going to make it extremely hard, I think, for traditional brick and mortar comic book resellers to stay in business.
Oh yeah, especially when Amazon takes the 30% and actually uses it to lower prices.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is what they're likely to do. It's what they did with books and music. It's what they're going to do here. They're going to pushing down the price of comic books, pushing them down, which, you know, at first comic book fans are going to be really excited about. But it will lead to fewer comics, and it will lead to comics that are less good, and it will lead to comics that have less good art, less good editing, less good creation. You know, at some point, there are going to be talented comic book creators who simply won't be able to afford to create comic books anymore.
And that's a tragedy, because we have hit a point in the creative side of the comic industry where we have moved far beyond what people see in the stereotypical view.
Oh yeah.
I mean, this is not the spandex cape.
No, there's some amazing art out there.
Oh
and
yeah.
Amazing stories.
Yeah. So amazing some stories. of the stories that I'm reading in comics now are just absolutely stellar, and they do not involve superheroes. I don't want to see that go away.
Mm-mm. We're in a golden age of comics. All right, we're at 52 minutes, man.
I told you we could make this 2 hours.
I know. Oh, totally. Absolutely. Yeah, it's an interesting topic. But let's move on to Found.
Oh yes, let's.
This week, a gentleman named Avram Miller. Who is the former vice president of business development for Intel. He's retired. He wrote a piece, a fake future piece that's like, you know, back in the summer of 2014 when Apple launched its search engine, you know, in other words, he's pretending to be in the future looking back at something that hasn't happened yet. And what he is proposing through this fictional story is that Apple is developing a search engine, that Apple has been working on the search engine for years and years and years, egged on and sparked in part by Steve Jobs' fury with Google for copying iOS, and that he started a super secret, draped in black cloak. I think the developers themselves are actually draped in black cloth like burkas. I'm kidding. Where it was a really small team, and the project's existence was even hidden from the board of directors. And it was that small, and it was that secret, and that their job was to basically reinvent search. And that this has been going on, and that Steve Jobs may, this is one of my favorite little details in the story, that Steve Jobs, on his deathbed or near to his deathbed, made Tim Cook promise to keep development of this engine. And that he recorded a message for the introduction of the search engine when it eventually launches to be played, you know, in 2014 or 2015 when it launches.
I hope it's a holographic Steve Jobs.
I just
at the end he bends over and pulls the data disk out of R2-D2. So you see him bending over in the hologram. I'm sorry, I'm still in nerd mode.
Help me, Tim Cook. You're my only hope. This is going to happen, and then he covers it, the last paragraph of the, it's only like four long paragraphs, but the last paragraph is dedicated to, was this real or wasn't it? So, you know, totally doing a CYA kind of thing. But supposedly part of the secret to the search engine is that Steve Jobs heard about some amazing engineer in actually he may be a scientist, I'm not sure which, in Israel, who is going to do to Google what Google did to Alta Vista with the PageRank algorithm.
Okay.
And that it's going to completely disrupt search. And adding intrigue to this, Mr. Miller has been spending the last like one season a year he spends in Israel working with technology companies. So, you know, the completely unstated implication there is that that's how he found out about this. And Robert X. Cringely wrote a little piece saying, I really like this. You know, this guy's my neighbor. I know him. I respect him. My kids swim in his pool and prefer his pool because it's heated. You know,
It's not my pool and my kids can get away from me.
Yeah, there's that too. And he said that, you know, that he really likes this rumor and he thinks that the story and he thinks that there's something to it. And that Apple would develop this and not need to monetize it, i.e. not need to do advertising. And basically be able to chop the legs out from under Google by taking away the desktop search space and then owning the mobile search space, which right now no one is winning.
Man, that would be an amazing coup. And in the process, killing Google's revenue stream, ad revenue stream.
Well, two ways. One, by taking share away and crushing Bing in the process. Right? That's one way.
Mm-hmm.
And the other way is, but so you take market share, that obviously is going to put the hurt on Google. But then in addition to that, if you're like, you know, Apple could take market share away and give the product away for free like Microsoft did with Internet Explorer.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Of course, I had major issues with that. We can talk about that another time when we haven't gone on so much. But Apple can take share away without and do it ad free, and that puts a hurt on Google. But if Apple were to expand iAd and actually try to develop search as an advertising revenue stream on top of that, that would put a double hurt on Google, because then it would be siphoning off some dollars that would otherwise go to Google. So it could be a 1-2 punch for Google, and it depends on how good it is, and exactly how Apple presents it, and whether or not it's open. You know, if Apple allows only iOS or Apple device owners to use it, well, that will obviously limit its potential.
I think it would be foolish for Apple to limit their search just to their own devices.
Okay, well, they're doing that with Maps. That's foolish.
Yes, it is. Well, I don't think it's foolish today. In a couple years, when Maps has matured more, then it becomes foolish.
I think Maps should be available through a browser, just like Google Maps. I think Apple should release APIs for it and do all kinds of things.
I think that will come.
Maybe. I hope so. I certainly hope so. It actually kind of drives me nuts. But, you know, I wrote a piece a little more than a year ago, sometime in 2013, about saying that Apple needs to get into search, and that with search they can make Siri better and they can make Maps better, and that all these things go hand in hand, as Google has proven. And I made the case for it. I think I made a strong case. And that's part of why I like Mr. Miller's fictional story so much, because it dovetails. He actually, some of what he lays out are some of the same reasons that I laid out for Apple wanting to do it. So, you know, there's my bias.
And you got some validation in your idea, so there's that too.
Yeah, and that's always, you know, I need that.
Yeah.
So, it's a fascinating story, and I think the idea of an Apple search engine would resonate with a lot of folks.
Yeah, I'm intrigued. I actually would love to see an Apple search engine.
And he said it was going to be called Found, which I think is a great name for a search engine.
Yes. Yes, it is.
You know, I found it. It's just, it's such a, it's such a, you know, Bing, I've actually come to, Bing didn't strike me. I didn't like Bing at first. It seemed like, well, you know, I guess this is the shortest name we can come up with, so I guess that's fine. You know, it's kind of always felt what like Bing was. It was,
I've never liked the name. It has never grown on me.
It's grown on me a little bit. It really
like
honestly,
like beautiful flowers or a rash.
Like a field of clover. It's grown on me.
That's such a nice image, and for me, yeah. it's still a barren wasteland of a name.
fair enough. And I'm not going to try to defend it, but Found to me is a great name for a search engine.
I think it is too.
You know, it works for my Found It. What I really like is when Let Me Google That For You, which is, I think, hilarious. When that becomes Let Me Find That For You.
Yes.
You know, that would be really, really appropriate. And, you know, so I don't know. The real thing here is Mr. Miller theorizing, or... Because everything he lays out to me is perfectly logical. I said in my piece a year ago, I said there is zero chance that Apple doesn't have a search engine somewhere. There is zero chance.
Yeah,
Apple absolutely has the product. We've talked about this a lot. You know, you look at any given product, there is zero chance that Apple hasn't looked at it, maybe made a prototype, sketched up some models. Johnny Ives, you know, did something in clay. I mean, you know, the any given product, there is zero chance that Apple hasn't looked at it and talked about it. There is zero chance that Apple does not have the beginnings of a search engine somewhere in its labs. And this could just, you know, Mr. Miller could have just been theorizing based on that. You know, he looks at Steve Jobs saying that, you know, he wanted to go thermonuclear war against Google for stealing his product. And you know, he mentioned when Steve Jobs said, you know, they went into phones. We didn't go into search. And, you know, just looking at that, like, well, what does that mean? You know, and just looking at all the logic of the situation, it would certainly make sense for Apple to chop the legs out from Google in any way that it can. Or is he basing this on something that he knows for real?
Wouldn't it be fun if he knew something?
He's connected and respected, according to Mr. Cringely, Robert X. Cringely.
And what a wonderful way to present this to all of us, instead of saying, well, here's what I know from my insider sources. Give us a little story instead.
Yeah, and then be coy about it. Was it real or wasn't it?
Yeah, just
super coy. Super coy in such a ham-fisted way, and it works.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, here we are talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our readers readers were largely positive about this. You know, someone said this is... first time I've been actually, he said giddy, which is kind of funny because he spelled it with two T's. But anyway, people are excited about this idea. People reacted positively to my story, my column a year ago, arguing why Apple needed to do it. Now, Google fans, of course, were, I read some comments on I think it was Mr. Cringely's response, where, you know, guy laid out all the reasons why Apple would fail with the search engine, and it was completely illogical, but whatever. Google fans will say that Apple can never do it, and that no one will ever use it, and Google rules, and all this stuff. And that's fine, too. Google's not going to go away just because Apple releases a search engine.
Oh, no.
But Apple could put the hurt on their profits.
They could.
It's desktop search at Google that pays for everything else.
And having a search engine system that can be tightly integrated into Apple's products, that's kind of intriguing.
Yeah. Yes, and you know, again, too, this everything builds, you know, Siri and Maps and local search that Apple has talked so much about. Understanding what people mean when they're looking for information is of enormous value. And right now, Google is king of that. Absolutely king of that. So Eric Schmidt joked that they know what we're thinking before we do.
And while he joked, the laughter that went along with that was uncomfortable because,
oh yeah,
it's kind of true.
It is true. But that's the reality, is that you know, IBM could do this if they wanted to, I'm sure, to do some aspect of this. I mean, you know, Google is the king of this now. Google is the king of the creep factor now. You know, with Google, we are the product, all that sort of stuff. You know, with Apple, see, but that's the thing. If Apple didn't bother to monetize this, if they let the hardware profits pay for it, then I could stop being the product. Wouldn't that be awesome?
That's very compelling.
But I don't know that they would. Apple sells ads today. iAd exists. You know, they're constantly rejiggering it, but iAd exists. They do sell ads. They are trying to monetize iTunes Radio. They are trying to monetize free apps for developers. So I don't know. I don't know that they would do a search engine for truly free, but they might.
It would be cool.
It would be cool as long as it's being paid for by as long as it's being paid for something that I can directly pay for.
Yes. You know,
Google search engine is paid for by ads, and that means that it's paid for by chopping us up and selling us. I'd much rather pay for found by buying a new iPhone or buying a new iPad or buying a new Mac.
Yes, and you know, and maybe part of the money we pay for iCloud add-ons, you know, like iTunes Match, stuff like that. An extra storage would supplement that. So instead of directly paying, the fees we're paying for other things are supplementing the search.
Well, Siri today, we don't send Apple a check for $10. Send people a check. I'm old. We pay for Siri by paying so much for an iPhone that Apple makes a lot of profit on it.
Sure,
that's what pays for Siri. But I would rather directly pay for stuff that way. I would rather directly pay Apple high enough margins that Apple can make a profit and do R&D and do new things and give you know, give shareholders a dividend. I would rather pay for that stuff than to have it be quote unquote free, but I'm being chopped up and sold.
Yeah, I agree. I think it would be very empowering for customers. And it could be a very useful tool for Apple's own marketing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, yeah. I like this idea.
I do too. I hope there's something to it. I hope there's some smoke to this particular fire, or fire to this particular smoke, or however that works. Some water somewhere. I don't know. One of the elements. Earth, wind, and fire.
Yes. Ha!
James Brown somewhere.
That's right.
All right, we are so over, man. We are so over.
But somehow we did manage to keep it under 2 hours.
We did, but we're
at a point where I should take us out, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at ACM at MacObserver.com. Thanks for listening. Feel free to follow me on Twitter and app.net. I'm JGam at both places. And please go over to the iTunes store and rate our show, because like we've already established, Brian does need validation.
No, it's a bad reason.
I need validation too.
Wait. And by the way, yes.
Love. It's for love. Do it
and
for
as long
love.
As the show is, this may be actually part of next week's Apple Context Machine too. You can follow me on Twitter at TM O'Brien. Jeff is at freshbrewtales.com. I'm at geektales.com. We have the URLs in the show notes. Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom. Recorded just for us. And that's all for this week.
And as always, stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer.
Do it for love.